film, Judgment at Nuremberg, involves the scene featuring Judy Garland. In that scene, Judy Garland plays a woman based on a real person called Irina Zeiler, a woman who was sent to a German prison as a teenager because of involvement in a racial crime trial in 1935, Rassenschande. So the character that Garland plays, she was accused of having a sexual relationship with a German Jewish man. There was a trial in Nazi Germany. The Jewish man was executed, and she was sent to prison. In the movie, post-war, an American tribunal hears the charges against the judge, right, who condemned that German Jewish man to death. The scene is incredibly intense. The German defense lawyer screams at the Judy Garland character, you know, asking her to go back in time. Did you sit on his lap? While the American judges watch on. But think about the context. In 1965, sex, marriage between Black and white Americans was against the law in almost every single state. Anti-miscegenation laws in almost every single state. And across the country, intimate relations between Black and white Americans were extremely dangerous and perilous. So again, thinking about how these events, like, collide in the viewing of that film. Another sort of embodiment of this links of Black and Jewish lives and histories comes in the form of friendship. Depicted here is a very, I think, famous friendship between the Jewish theologian Abraham Joshua Heschel and Martin Luther King. Heschel marched with King at Selma and famously said, "My feet were praying." Both men recognized the profound solidarity embodied in their friendship and its significance. But there were also forces that threatened to pull them apart. In a 1958 speech to the American Jewish Congress, Martin Luther King articulated those forces, and Amy will read it.
"My people were brought to America in chains. Your people were driven here to escape the chains fashioned for them in Europe. Our unity is born of our common struggle for centuries, not only to rid ourselves of bondage, but to make oppression of any people by others an impossibility. There are Hitlers loose in America today, both in high and low places. As the tensions and bewilderment of economic problems become more severe, history's scapegoats, the Jews, will be joined by new scapegoats, the Negroes. The Hitlers will seek to divert people's minds and turn their frustrations and anger to the helpless, to the outnumbered. Then whether the Negro and Jew shall live in peace will depend upon how firmly they resist, how effectively they reach the minds of the decent Americans to halt this deadly diversion."
Thank you. Thank you for that reading. These links can be really inspiring, but they're not always welcomed. When Toni Morrison dedicated her novel Beloved to the 60 million, she was criticized as a Holocaust denier or minimizer. The American literature scholar Danielle Christmas explained that Morrison did not mean to displace Jews, but rather to join them. Christmas herself has done really interesting work on, you can see the title, Auschwitz and the Plantation, how those themes are intermingled in American literature. I once saw her give a talk on this subject on Zoom during COVID, where she pointed out that the American TV series Holocaust, which came out in 1978, drew heavily on the epic, the slavery epic from the year before, Roots. When she made that observation, the chat filled up with criticisms that she was appropriating the Holocaust, distorting it, that this comment was offensive and inappropriate. However, Christmas was pointing to something really quite significant, which is that the field of Holocaust owes a huge debt to African-American studies and to the civil rights movement, because it's precisely in that era that the study of the Holocaust emerged as a field in American history, and vocabulary like passing, like slave labor, even the whole way of thinking about race These have come into the Holocaust field from African American studies, not the other way around. I want to close this section with the obvious point that connecting the Holocaust, comparing to other cases of violence, is not something new, and it has served many purposes. I won't go through those all. I would say some of those purposes I find laudable, others not. But all of them attest to the universal claim and the universal significance of the Holocaust. So let me turn to the conclusion. I hope you won't be too disappointed that I don't really have a resounding conclusion to tie everything up, but rather some important quotations, reflections, and a call to keep thinking about the links, anti-Semitism, anti-Black racism, and misogyny. So first, an important quote from Heschel, again, just reminding us of the importance of not despairing. I'm going to read it. "Racism is an evil of tremendous power, but God's will transcends all powers. Surrender to despair is surrender to evil. It is important to feel anxiety. It is sinful to wallow in despair." I want to also bring a challenge from another speaker who did not survive the Holocaust, Gustava Yaretzka, a Jewish writer in the Warsaw Ghetto, who used her last strength, she was murdered in Treblinka, to document the history of the destruction of her community for a future that she would not live to see. Matthew will read it for us.
"The record must be hurled like a stone under history's wheel in order to stop it. One can lose all hopes except the one that the suffering and destruction of this war will make sense when they are looked at from a distant historical perspective, from suffering unparalleled in history, from bloody tears and bloody sweat. A chronicle of days of hell is being composed, which will help explain the historical reasons for why people came to think as they did and why regimes arose that caused such suffering."
Thank you. This is a real challenge to thinking about the power of history, right? Another, I think, challenge closer to home in time and place comes from James Baldwin, his 1985 book, The Evidence of Things Not Seen. Baldwin's analysis here, I think, is as incisive and relevant now as it was 40 years ago, calling us to find the courage to look and see what is going on, and Maureen will read it.
"The cowardice of this time and place, this era, is nowhere more clearly revealed than in the perpetual attempt to make the public and social disaster the result or the issue of a single demented creature, or perhaps half a dozen such creatures, who have quite incomprehensibly gone off their rockers and who must be murdered or locked up. Thus, for example, these present days, to describe a person or group of persons as leftists, guerrillas, or terrorists is to dismiss their claims to human attention. We are not compelled to think of them at all anymore, except as the vermin that must be destroyed. Or, in another way, but for the same reason, we are still attempting to explain Hitler away. We do not wish to see him in our mirror."
For me, one of the concepts that has been helpful to think about recognizing these links is the concept of a conversation where equal autonomous partners both listen and speak, that importance of listening. And another important concept is the concept of commonalities. Nate Leipziger, Polish-Jewish survivor who lives in Toronto, gave me, in his terms, this concept, commonalities, to describe how he came to work and present together with a number of survivors of Indigenous residential schools in Canada. For Leipziger and Eugene Arcand and other conversation partners, they did not equate their experiences, but they focused on their common trauma and common loss. One of those common traumas was sexual abuse, which Leipziger, Arcand, and many other survivors of residential schools endured, both boys and girls. And for Nate Leipziger, the Holocaust survivor, talking and sharing that common experience of sexual abuse was incredibly emboldening. He never talked about it until his friendship with Ted Fontaine and Eugene Arcand. Thinking about commonalities made me sort of think about the commonalities that go below the surface. including the commonalities, you could say, of the grave, of bodies. A few years ago in Saskatchewan, where I come from in Western Canada, excavation of unmarked graves around a residential school site found human remains, a fragment of a jawbone of a child. You could see here that press release where the First Nations talk about that finding. I couldn't stop thinking about the words of a writer from the Holocaust period over the graves of murdered children, poisoned flowers grow. And to think about how the legacies of loss, the resilience that somehow is fought despite that legacy of loss, is shared across every case of human suffering and violence. From solidarity, from commonalities, it's a small step to solidarity. And here I want to draw attention to a poem, 2014 poem, by the Palestinian poet Nawwan Darwish, called Who Remembers the Armenians? Darwish took that title from Hitler's taunt in 1939 when Germany was about to invade Poland. Who remembers the Armenians? Like, we will have impunity like that. And to hear this poem, we have Aaron.
Who remembers the Armenians? I remember them, and I ride the nightmare bus with them each night. And my coffee this morning, I'm drinking it with them. You murderer, who remembers you?
Thank you. I want to end with one last quotation. This one not from someone famous or from a poet, not so eloquent, but rather from a woman who survived the Holocaust. She's from Bulgaria and reflects on what it might mean. With hesitancy, with self-consciousness, with uncertainty, but also with humanity. And Aaron will read this one for us as well.
I always wonder what it have been with me as a person, as a human being, if I didn't have a little bit of suffering in my life. Thank God we weren't killed and all that, but this helped me so much to become a human being. I know that today I cannot say about the blacks or to say the yellows. I cannot say anything because I know how deprived I felt when those in power were against me. So this maybe helped a little bit. I don't know. Maybe it's a crazy thing to say.
And that's the note I want to end on. This maybe helped a little bit. I don't know. Maybe it's a crazy thing to say. Thank you for your attention.
I honestly didn't grow up learning that much about the Holocaust. It's not something I'm proud of at all. It just didn't come from a great town. But wasn't Hitler's whole thing creating some sort of like superior race? And wouldn't that kind of be relevant to what you're speaking about?
I think this is like a simple way people like, you know, the perfect race or whatever. There's more confusion around that idea. Much more, I guess, important is to think about that idea of dominance, because you could see like that propaganda of the perfect race and so on. But if you actually look at how Nazi programs of killing operated, you could see, you know, at the center, Jews being targeted, not because they were deemed imperfect or inferior, but because they were deemed to be supposedly the enemies of the Aryan race. And you also see that the first victims of mass killing were people with disabilities. And often people say, well, that was about making the perfect race. But again, scholars have really been working on this. Only certain kinds of people with disabilities were killed. So, for example, often people who were deemed useful for labor were allowed to stay alive. People who were deemed useless eaters were killed. So in addition to that idea of the so-called superior race, it's really about domination. What's the hallmark of a superior race? Hitler was a social Darwinist. If you're not expanding in a social Darwinism view, you're being pushed back, right? And what allows expansion? Two things, soldiers and babies, which they kind of boil down to the same. So that idea of the superior race is less, I think, what's often imagined is they wanted everyone to be blonde and blue-eyed. You know, there's all those jokes, right? What does the perfect Aryan look like? Slim like Goering, you know, who was a fat guy. Handsome like Himmler, very homely. Blonde like Hitler. Like, they even realized it doesn't make any sense. But the big thing is about power, domination, expansion. So almost the ideology of we're creating this perfect future is just like almost one of the tools in the package of, yeah, expansion, domination, a military state that is going to be, you know, controlling its neighbors, absorbing those deemed valuable, and eradicating those deemed worthless. So, yeah, thanks for that.
Doris, can you chat about how your Mennonite background in Saskatchewan ties into your work?
You know, questions like that, they always make me a bit uncomfortable because I feel like being a scholar, it's not just about I study this because that's who I am. I never was interested in Canadian history. Is that bad to say? I don't feel like because I'm Canadian, I had to study Canadian history. And yet it is an interesting question. So my background is Mennonite. It's not so much the religious background, but my parents were born in Soviet Union, Soviet Ukraine in the 1920s. They came to Canada as children. And I never wanted to study like my own family history or things like that. But you bring certain tools that almost allow you to do certain things because of your background. I spent 11 years in various Christian schools. And because of that, I learned a lot about like the Bible and stuff. So I could study military chaplains in a certain way because I understood certain things. And that's definitely linked to my background. Same with some aspects of the Holocaust. I didn't learn German at home from my parents, but my grandparents spoke like German, Russian, Ukrainian. I heard those, made it easier for me to learn that. So I think it's not like a straight on thing. I feel like, you know, oh, I'm a white person, so I have to study white people, or I'm a woman, so I have to study women. I feel like the great thing about scholarship is you can develop the tools to pursue the things that interest you, and the connections might not always be obvious. Nevertheless, I would say who you are doesn't shape, you know, what you do as a scholar directly, but it shapes kind of what you think about, what seems important to you. You know what I mean? What strikes you as significant or interesting? So that's what I would say. And then more specific, if anyone is interested in Mennonite history, there is a project I did together with Mark Jansen and a guy called John Thiessen called European Mennonites and the Holocaust. And it's actually really important thinking about the role of Mennonites, including as killers, which is kind of shocking to people who think Mennonites are pacifist. Thanks.
Do you have any idea about how to counter racism, misogyny, and anti-Semitism and scapegoating? And then she adds this caveat, reflecting the time kind of we live in, of the current administration. And then the comment is immediately challenged, again, reflecting the time we live in, by somebody who says, like, what are you talking about anti-Semitism of the current administration? They're certainly not anti-Semitic. So again, but the main point, of course, is like countering these things you're just so very eloquently analyzed.
If I had a really good answer to that question, you know, would I be like a professor, you know, at a university, whatever? I mean, this is the crucial question. And it seems to me it's the question that goes right back to us, right? It's like, how do you counter things? You try to recognize them. You try to see them. You try to listen to the people on the receiving end, right, of those threats and violence. And I think, you know, you try to find solidarity with others rather than thinking, oh, I'm only concerned about my own people or my own family or my own group. You try to find some solidarity. I feel like that is a really crucial point, some strength in numbers. But yeah, I think this is like the challenge for each of us, right? Looking out, like, what is the world around us right now? And how do we find the people we trust and our friends? Even if you do like something as basic as like helping one person, it could be a really concrete thing. So that's what I think. You got to find your allies and friends. Thanks to all of you for being here. Thank you.
You were just listening to Doris Bergen, Anti-Semitism, Anti-Black Racism, and Misogyny. She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder in February. Doris Bergen is Professor of Holocaust Studies at the University of Toronto. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Gabor Mate, Shama Sawant, Chris Hedges, Tariq Ali, Norman Finkelstein, and Francesca Albanese. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Doris Bergen, Anti-Semitism, Anti-Black Racism, and Misogyny, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Daniel Berenboim performing Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3. My name's Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. It is a sunny, sunny Thursday, except not exactly that warm, unfortunately. I'd like to welcome you all to The Angry Young Man. Firstly, before we do get into the mix of things, just like to remind you all that everything that is said today by myself and my guest is not necessarily representative of the views of WRCT or its members and are strictly those of myself and my guest, which let's get right into it with introducing my wonderful guest. A friend of mine is going to be Ilyas Khan. How you doing?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. I don't know. It's middle of the second semester, so what more can you say?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's got that vibe to it, especially once, you know, it's supposed to be nice and warm now and you're getting February temperatures back.
Oh boy. Yep. Yeah. I totally feel it. It was like 70 degrees last week and I was outside tanning and it was
beautiful.
Horrible.
Well, so, you know, for those of you just tuning in, Ilyas, you are a member of the Sunrise Movement in Pittsburgh.
Yes, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about Sunrise?
Yeah, 100%. So I'm actually the hub coordinator of our local Sunrise Movement hub. And what Sunrise Movement essentially is and does is it's a youth-oriented climate justice movement, right? So it's not just an organization, but really it's a concept of how to make change around climate change and climate justice on a local level. And my job, really, with Sunrise Movement is just to make sure that we are engaging with our community and we are, you know, moving apace in terms of making actual direct climate policy change. So that's kind of my position, and you know, over the past 2 years I've been in the position, you know, it's been really wonderful to get to know and really work with Allegheny County communities on issues of climate justice.
So what are some ways that you've kind of practically worked with our communities in Allegheny County and work to kind of push for change.
Absolutely. So there's been some really wonderful things happening at the county level, particularly recently, but also in the past. A few years ago, we were part of the coalition that managed to pass a ban on fracking in public parks, which apparently you could do until a few years ago. And there were huge risks, kind of, you know, if you've grown up in Southwest PA, you know just how dangerous a lot of the frack gas wells can be, especially for children, right? So to have that, you know, just out in the open where children are playing was a huge risk to public safety, and we managed to put a stop to any future construction of those frack gas wells. And just recently, we were part of the major push to have the new administration draft a climate action plan, really a comprehensive plan to address more than just climate, but also things like housing inequity, flood and emergency services, healthcare, all kinds of stuff, really, that are integral to creating a sustainable Allegheny County in the years to come.
Yeah, I mean, for those of you who have been listening to the show for the past couple weeks, you'll know that we spoke a little bit to this issue of, you know, kind of a localized climate-related or environmental policy-related actions taken, particularly by determining what the particular needs and wants or sacrifices that a community wants to make, depending on their situation. And that's, you know, something that you've kind of very practically dealt with hands-on, and something I did want to kind of drill into a little bit, just because, you know, not, you know, no pun intended on the fracking, but you know, the issue of housing in Allegheny County and Pittsburgh, that's something that I haven't had the opportunity to kind of talk about here and would love to kind of address with you, particularly because there are a couple things at play right now. You know, firstly, with new administration, like you'd mentioned, there's a policy goal in the area that the Inamorato administration has, particularly something that she had campaigned on, which I find to be particularly concerning, was the housing reassessment that she and her administration is embarking on currently, which many people pointed to during that election season as something which would disproportionately hurt large swaths of the Pittsburgh and Allegheny County communities that would have the assessment of their property put at a higher level, pushing them to pay more in property tax. Particularly something that I would say has the opportunity to, especially if this is something that is being pressed on to people who rent out. You have you know, when someone's renting out to a college student or someone who's in lower income bracket, when they have their property taxes raised, that's something that's going to get passed along in cost in rent. And that's something, you know, obviously we want to avoid that, especially for people who are in less of a position to provide capital upfront for their renting purposes. And to increase that is to push a higher detriment upon them. And that's something that, you know, one thing I was concerned about, and the second thing that I'm not too sure about, if that's something that's being pursued by the administration, but there was a mention during the campaign of a tenant's bill of rights, which involved within it, to my understanding, the basis for price controls on rent, which I've spoken about before on the show, particularly in the first time around, but also spoke about it a little bit in length on my talk on rent controls in Argentina, kind of talking about the issues that are inherent to price controls and what that ends up passing on to in cost to renters. So I'm curious to get some reflections from you in regards to, you know, someone who's had the opportunity to work on drafting housing-related policy to suggest to the administration in Allegheny County.
Absolutely. So most of the policy that I've engaged with is less directly housing, but it is related through questions of sustainability as well as affordability and equity as a whole, you know. And I think you bring up a great point. that, you know, when we have questions of tax reassessment and redistribution, oftentimes this can end up heavily affecting marginalized communities, particularly Black and Brown communities, but also, you know, more urban communities that depend more heavily on renting. But I think, you know, you brought up the idea of a tenant's bill of rights. You know, on the one hand, right, your fear about the potential for how tenants can be disproportionately impacted by these reassessments is very much valid and justified, and I share it, as a matter of fact. But I think to have a tenant's bill of rights isn't necessarily, you know, pushing us towards an Argentinian model per se, but I think it does open up a lot of avenues for tenants to actually have a greater degree of decision-making power in their own rental situations. And that, as well as the insured protections for those tenants, which are, you know, a natural product of that Bill of Rights, would sort of, hopefully, you know, assuming I haven't quite seen a draft of that Bill of Rights, but you know, assuming the All In for Allegheny County survey, which I don't know if you were aware of.
Yes, I haven't had the opportunity to kind of look through it, but I was aware that was circulating at the moment. Yeah,
right. So there are some questions about housing, as I recall. It was a very long survey. Sarah, next time you do that, please give us a heads up about how long it's going to be. I think to have a Bill of Rights might help alleviate some of that potential stress, because it would put renters in greater control of that whole dynamic, and allow for more negotiation between tenants and their landlords.
Well, I too am not very familiar with a lot of the things that were proposed in it. Just one thing that stood out to me during that process was the prospect of potential rent control in Allegheny County. And that, you know, the reason I bring up Argentina is because nationally in 2020 there was an ordinance passed for the institution of rent controls in Argentina. And, you know, rent controls are one primary thing, but even looking at other potential regulation regarding the relationship between tenant and landlord, when you impose, firstly, rent controls on a landlord, you know, this is your ceiling for charging rent. At a certain point, it becomes more profitable for these landlords to sell the properties than to further provide housing as an opportunity, which contracts the supply of available rental housing. And that's a primary concern there, but also at the same time, what you saw in Argentina was a lot of the times landlords would forego very expensive repair or maintenance on the property just because of the other absorbed cost that would come by having a much higher overhead compared to now a restricted rent, which in many cases, hopefully this would not be the case in Allegheny County, but specifically in a high inflation economy, is not very adaptable to the needs of suppliers in that case. So that's kind of one thing there, but also just in terms of other kind of like more abstract non-economic regulation, you know, just the attractiveness of providing housing and to try to do so in a competitive market for housing, so as to try to attract a renter to say, this is the place that I would want to live over this other place, because they're offering potentially better amenities, lower rent. My concern is that in attempting to regulate that market, we might end up seeing a more rigid structure, which doesn't allow for landlords to kind of compete against each other and ultimately allow the consumers, in this case the renters, to be able to make better choices with a better selection of available renting opportunities. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, Argentina's history with rental control doesn't start in 2020. It actually starts in the 1920s with the first rental control policies that were instituted there. And, you know, even in the 1920s, they were struggling with it. But, you know, it was far more sustainable because of Argentina's much smaller population, right? You didn't have... Buenos Aires was not like a city of 20 million like it is now. You know, and similarly, you know, rental control policies existed across, you know, many countries at that period of time, because it just it simply made more sense, you know, in terms of like both the labor market and also the housing market. I think here, you know, I'm not a big fan of landlords personally. Mm-hmm. I believe very firmly in the democratization of rental, meaning that tenants should actually have unions, which would then own apartment complexes and help regulate rent, you know, such that the needs of the tenants are provided for by virtue of it being a tenant-owned space. But because we're working with a system in which we have landlords, I think, you know, this question of whether or not... I mean, right now what we are seeing in this housing market is very large companies will essentially become landlords, right? And they have no incentive to compete with other companies because they're not even from here, right? A lot of these groups, like, they have no real stakes in Pittsburgh, right? A lot of the housing developers have no real stake in Pittsburgh. A lot of the apartment owners have no real stake in Pittsburgh. It's just about the production of capital, which, you know, it's not really serving the consumers as much as I would like. And I think imposing, if not rental control, but some way of ensuring that the people who are owning these properties, who are renting these properties, have a vested stake in the community, right? Some sort of imposition like that, I think, should be a minimum, right? Because if you don't have a stake in the community, if that... if you don't see the Pittsburgh community as something that you are a part of and therefore should engage with and provide for, then I really don't think you should be a landlord, because you're only going to put your own tenants and yourself at a disadvantage, because your turnover rate will probably be incredibly high if you're not interested in and invested in the community you're a part of and creating.
Well, firstly, you know, I definitely agree on the premise of trying to encourage community. And, you know, I very firmly believe that you're always going to have a better relationship with, you know, your local mom and pop than you are with, you know, your local Target. But what I will say at the same time is two things. Firstly, you know, any supplier of any good is ultimately going to be beholden to the people who consume from them. And I would say in the case of, you know, like, let's take some large company that's decided to grab some skin in the game in the Pittsburgh rental market. They want to be as attractive as possible to the Pittsburgh rental community in order to attract people to rent from their properties. And that puts them up against other people in this market. And that may be other large actors, maybe two or three, and then a combined medley of, you know, individual rent landlords who have maybe one to three or four properties that they rent. These people, I mean, while you all have larger competitors in there, to my understanding, Pittsburgh is not under... I know Walnut Capital is a very large renter in Pittsburgh, a large landlord in Pittsburgh, but is one of many actors in the Pittsburgh rental market. And what I think is so great about, you know, there's, and something I want to get back to was the conceptualization of, kind of union owned, housing, communities, that you'd brought up. And I kind of want to hear a little bit more about that in a second, but what I think is interesting is, you know, when you have, in a ideally free market, when the renters are looking at their options, their ability to allocate their capital to wherever they see is the most worthy of doing so, allows them to influence the action of these actors that are trying to provide housing in this case. You know, you want to stick it to these people that are trying to jack your rent up 25% in this one neighborhood. You know, you say, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, my good friend Joe in Shadyside is offering me a better going rate. While it may be another 10-minute commute, that the marginal utility that I gain from choosing this over what you're giving me is going to be higher, so I'm going to go that way. And then Walnut Capital could be like, well, no. We want you to stay here. Might prevent them from going through with that. You know, you have across the board things like inflation or economic conditions, which will cause rents across the board to raise, and there's nothing you could really do about that. And in the case in which you institute rent controls, you end up having the negative economic shock of prices not adjusting on all ends, and you end up disadvantaging one player in the equation over the other, and that's when you start to have issues.
Well, you know, what I would say to that is that, like, the players are already, you know, they've had their legs cut at the ankle, right, in a lot of these cases. And I think it's, I mean, we're sitting here at Carnegie Mellon. We're coming to this from an incredibly privileged perspective, right? Because we can afford to say, well, I've got a buddy Joe who can provide me a better going rate. But, you know, if you're a black or brown tenant in the city of Pittsburgh, you know, oftentimes your choice is between a rock and a hard place. I mean, and this is how gentrification has occurred across the city, where huge swaths of communities like East Liberty, like The Hill, like others, Highland Park and more, where and Oakland is probably the most egregious example, right, in the city, where the original population has been slowly displaced and replaced because of these kind of rental turnover. And where have they been forced to go? They've either been forced to leave the city or they've been forced to move to the suburbs. And this is why Pittsburgh is one of the worst cities in the country for black Americans to live in. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen those statistics.
I have seen that, yes.
And, you know, that's atrocious, right? Like, I think you and I are both on the same page that, like, a city should be a livable place for everyone, regardless of who you are and what your economic standing may be. You know, there should at least be, you know, the option for you to be safe and comfortable in your own community, right? And so I think, like, when we're talking about the issue of, you know, competition and things like that in the local renters market, we have to have a measure of sensitivity to that reality for those disadvantaged tenants, because, like, you know, if you're a student in Oakland, still many students in Oakland are disadvantaged. I've spoken to so many students at Pitt who are, you know, tenants for Walnut Capital, who are like, I can't really find anywhere else, mm-hmm. you know, because if you're trying to be a student in Pittsburgh, living in Oakland is one of your best options.
Yeah.
Public transit, access to food and water, like, you know, there's so much that you're dependent on here
yeah.
in Oakland. So I think, you know, there's more factors than just, like, the market itself in Pittsburgh that
yeah.
we have to be cognizant of.
Well, and I'd extend it to say, and I think this might be an area where we have some agreement, that current zoning in the city of Pittsburgh in a lot of areas works against the ability to develop enough housing to meet the demand. I went to a very interesting talk last week. The gentleman, Nolan Gray, who spoke, talking about zoning and current requirements for minimum parking, kind of things that bar the development of greater supply. And, you know, because, I mean, I know we're coming at from different angles, and I think that where we find overlap is a wonderful place. And I'm curious, you know, kind of where this would come on your end as well, but kind of coming from the market's perspective of this, you know, anytime you're looking at a raising of prices in a particular market, you're going to say, well, there's obviously demand rising here and the supply is just not meeting it. In a lot of ways, we need to look to build our supply in the city of Pittsburgh for housing. And a large issue with that is the difficulty to develop. It's obviously not as bad as... I'm from Suffolk County, New York. And it's terrible, the zoning out that way. You know, especially considering the fact that, you know, so many people are leaving. You know, it's a much more drastic case of what's already happened in Allegheny County. You know, people are leaving because they can't find affordable housing. And a lot of that has to do with a lack of supply driving up the pricing. And we really need to, if we're going to take any serious steps towards trying to have a long-term plan for, you know, how do we address affordability, I would say, you know, we're looking to advise a new incoming, well, not incoming, but now a, you know, a fresh administration at the county level. How do we address this issue? We should really start by looking at things that we can do at no cost to the taxpayer or to any negative impact on the economy, which comes in the form of zoning reform. And I think that that might be a wonderful place to kind of start if we're looking at ways for us to equitably deal with the issue of affordability.
I agree. I absolutely, I think that's, it's such an underrated part of local politics is zoning. I think everyone kind of thinks of it as rather boring. But it really is so crucial to every part of the process of urban development and planning. And I think, you know, in our city, like, on the one hand, yes, it's very hard to... there's also an issue of geography, right? Mm-hmm. Like, on top of that. I mean, I live down in a valley, right? And
yeah.
And not far from where that proposed development was. I don't know if you...
Is it the Mon Valley... not sure exactly.
It was a development that was proposed that was going to be like right in the middle of that chunk of Frick Park.
Vaguely,
right,
vaguely
down
aware
forward.
Of it. I would have to look into it more, but even for the listeners who might not be aware, just a quick summary.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you're ever driving on Forward and you go down the Forward Hill down towards Swiss Home Park in Swissvale, you know, that whole winding road on the left side, you know, you'll see a Walnut Towers, and then below that it's all Frick Park, right? And that area, this sort of chunk where the old Irish Center is, can't build an apartment complex on it. And the intention was to build an apartment complex on it by a Toronto-based firm for luxury condos for, like, basically old people moving out of Squirrel Hill.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's constructed, I mean, the architecture for it was painful to look at, but, you know, that aside, you know, it was constructed in such a way that it proved to be more ecologically hazardous and also, like, physically hazardous for its residents.
Gotcha.
Than anything else, because we have some roads in Pittsburgh and some places in Pittsburgh where it's damn near impossible to cross certain roads.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have access to public transit or if the road is, like, there's not even sidewalks on Forward.
Yeah.
Right? You know, how are you going to expect a bunch of old people from Squirrel Hill to kind of live in this, like, you know, mountainside monastery? They're never going to get out, right? Yeah. And so I think, like, when we're talking about things like zoning reform and development, it has to be done with a lot more discretion in a place like Pittsburgh than it does in somewhere like New York. Like, I'm from upstate, right?
Yeah.
Buffalo's flat, right? It's like, if you've ever been to Buffalo, New York, it's just as far as the eye can see.
You're just seeing nothing.
You can see Niagara Falls from, like, the top of a tall building, you know, like, no more than 40 feet, and you can see the smoke. You know, but if you're in the city of Pittsburgh, it's not like that at all, you know? You've got things that are as, you know, massive and steep as Mount Washington and Polish Hill, and then areas that are actual floodplains like downtown. And so I think, like, I'm hoping that Sarah Namorado's new climate action plan that they're working on in the Office of Sustainability does include some serious criteria to look at, you know, how to rezone and put standards on development such that you're not actually putting the residents at risk, because, like, it's a dangerous place, like, in terms of climate and urban infrastructure here, because there's so little attention put into certain parts of the city. Mm-hmm. I think you'd agree. you know,
there are some areas that need a little TLC.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So that I think you and I are in perfect agreement on that. And I think, you know, if I hope Sarah Namorado will listen to us at some point. You know, I'm sure she'd be happy to. But yeah, if there is any change to be made, I think first and foremost, it should be one that holistically reinterprets how our zoning has worked in relation to the environment in the past, where it's been, you know, pretty much like any other American city, right? Like you just draft these zoning lines to either promote different kinds of inequity or to help safeguard certain industries, and instead should be really more looking at how we can better serve the Allegheny County community as a whole, rather than just any particular industry or any particular community.
Yeah. I mean, we are in our last minute over here. Any kind of closing thoughts on the issue?
I really think that, you know, in the next few years, we have a great opportunity with this new administration to push for some very direct sustainability initiatives in terms of housing. As well as in terms of more general urban planning, like complete streets programs, which would help reduce a lot of that stress that those residents might face if you build somewhere like near Frick Park,
yeah,
where you have such strong inclines. So I'm looking forward to working with Sarah Namorado and others in Allegheny County on making that a reality for us.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely very interested to see where this goes. I mean, you know, we have areas where we might split a little bit, but I definitely think that we have a lot of agreement in the right places. And I'd like to really thank you for coming on today.
Thank you.
It's been a wonderful conversation. And thank you all for listening. I hope you all have a wonderful day, and God bless.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
You know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
Yeah, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, anything, you need to tell an adult, someone you know and trust. That can be hard, but speaking up about a problem is what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
This is Chop Chop Pop 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 Knock Cop Stop Pop Lock Cop Cop Grop Dop Root Drop Flop Fop Lock Wop Hoop Pop Pop Knock Cop Loop Lop Mop Pop Pop Flop Poop Pop Pop Drop Drop Scoop Chop Chop Sloop Slop Snoop Sop Stoop Drop Swap Swoop Swap Top.
Thank you.